Welcome to Basic Brewing Radio for Thursday, April 19th, 2007. I'm James Spencer. Here at Basic Brewing Radio, we're all about home brewing. Well, this week, Chris Colby from Brew Your Own Magazine joins us to tell us a tale of two IPAs, the traditional English standard and the rebellious American counterpart. Well, if you're new to home brewing or would like to get into the hobby, check out our website, basicbrewing.com, where you can find archives of our audio and video podcasts and our DVDs to walk you through the basic and more advanced brewing techniques. Well, here's a reminder. The American Homebrewers Association's 10th annual Big Brew Day is coming up on May the 5th. You can see details about the event as well as the three recipes that they're suggesting to brew on that big day on beertown.org. Also, I received an email from the AHA saying that in celebration of Big Brew Day, if you join the AHA by May 11th, you'll get a free book along with your membership. So check that out on beertown.org. I got a couple of questions that run along the same lines, so I'll kind of lump them together here. Jeff from Bremerton, Washington writes, "Here's my question for you and the other listeners. I've heard over and over that after bottling, you want to let it sit for 10 days or so to allow it to carbonate and then let it age. Okay, does that mean I should allow it to age sitting at room temperature or throw all the bottles in the fridge and age in there or both? What is the proper aging process? And if it is both, what are the benefits to either? Also, I heard from our friend Naween in India." It's been a while since I've gotten a letter from him, so it was good to hear from Naween. He says, "I'm back into brewing!" Double exclamation point. So that's good. When someone is bottle conditioning, Naween says, after priming and bottling, where does one store the beer? I usually bottle and then leave it at 32°C for a week, then transfer it to my fridge that is about 8°C. But you see, the problem here is I don't have a lot of space left in my fridge. Can homebrew after bottling be stored at 32 Celsius? Well, for those of us still in the dark ages of measuring temperature, 32°C is equivalent to about 90 degrees Fahrenheit. And 8°C, which is the temperature of his fridge, is around 46 degrees Fahrenheit. Now, from what I've read and heard, 32°C or 90°F is pretty warm for storing beer for any length of time. Short term, you're probably okay. But if you want to cellar your beer or age it, I'm afraid it might stale pretty quickly, relatively quickly at that high a temperature. Now, I've heard from different sources that beer is best stored in similar temperatures to wine storage temperatures, around 50 to 55 degrees Fahrenheit, or that would be around 10 to 13 Celsius. Lagers might like it a little cooler, and big beers might like it a little warmer. I myself store my beers in my basement once they're carbonated. I leave them at room temperature upstairs until they're carbonated, then I put them in the basement. In the wintertime, it hits a low of around 50 degrees Fahrenheit or 10 degrees Celsius, and in the summer, it climbs into the mid-60s or around 18 Celsius. But most of my beer doesn't stay around that long. I'm not talking about years here. For Jeff, unless you're trying to age a barley wine, I say once your beers get good and carbonated and tasty, feel free to keep them in the fridge if you have room. If your room temperature is relatively cool, if you've got an air conditioner, you're probably good there as well. But Naween has a different situation. He's got limited space in the fridge, and it's hot in India, at least to my standards. 90 degrees Fahrenheit is pretty darn warm. We here in Arkansas, we have the AC on. So I suggested that he brew in small batches so he wouldn't have a lot of beer to store. And Naween says he's already brewing in smaller volumes. So what do you say? Those of you who live in hot climates, what do you think? Do you experience premature staling of your beer if you keep it very warm, say 32°C or 90 Fahrenheit? And if it does, what strategies do you follow other than getting a dedicated beer fridge which is not practical for everybody to do for space considerations or other reasons. So what do you do? Drop me a line at james@basicbrewing.com or use the contact form on basicbrewing.com and let me know what you think. And, you know, don't forget to tell me where you're from if you do use the contact form, and be sure to check your email address so that I can so that my reply to you won't get bounced back. I got a fun email from Lars from Copenhagen, who apparently wrote while still in the air. Lars says, quick, what's the distance from Europe to Boston? Well, measured in Basic Brewing podcasts, about 5. And Lars says, this also allows time for a healthy nap. I don't know. I don't know if it's simultaneous or not. But anyway, Lars says, I flew from Copenhagen via Iceland to Boston and managed to listen to your 5 latest shows. Thanks for coming along for the ride. Well, thanks for taking us, Lars. And do we get frequent flyer miles, too? Because, you know, that'd be good. Lars says he especially enjoyed the sanitization shows. And I still get a lot of good feedback from those shows with Merle Landman from National Chemicals and Charlie Talley from Five Star Chemicals. Along those lines, Dave from Victoria, British Columbia, Canada writes in with a quick sanitizing tip. When it comes to creating an iodophore solution, the metric proportions are easy to remember. 1 milliliter of iodophore per liter of water. I measure mine with a 10cc, i.e. 10 milliliter syringe, minus the needle, into a 1 liter spritzer bottle, originally for misting houseplants. The spritzer bottle lets me spray down anything that needs it in a really quick and convenient way. There you go, 1 milliliter to 1 liter of water, 1 milliliter of iodophore per liter of water. Very good. That is quick and easy. Easy to remember. Mark from Waukesha, Wisconsin, I think I'm getting that right, says, what do you think about putting fruit in a beer? For example, lemon in Hefeweizen, orange in Witbier, lime in Gasp, Corona. Does this, in your opinion, take away from the originally intended flavor of the beer or complement it? Well, that's a good question, Mark. While we brag, you know, Steve and I brag on beer's ability to pair with foods, I have to say that I'm one that will take the fruit off my glass if I'm drinking a good beer. For instance, I think a lemon would mask some of the wonderful flavors that come from a Franziskaner Hefeweizen or a similarly crafted homebrew. However, I think a Corona, frankly, benefits from a lime wedge. But that's just my beer snobbiness coming through, though, probably. One of the biggest sins I've ever seen, beer-wise, in a restaurant was in a Mexican restaurant not far from here. I ordered a Bass Ale, and it came to me in the bottle with a chunk of lime sticking out of the top. So there you go. You know you're a beer geek when you get offended by fruit sticking out of your beer. David Morgan from Dunedin, Florida, who we interviewed in Orlando at the National Homebrewing Conference last year, you may remember he's one of the brewers who brews pepper beers, and they had some delicious pepper beers that we tasted down there. Anyway, David wrote in to tell us about a pepper beer homebrew competition down in Dunedin. I've been saying Dunedin the whole time, but he says it's more like saying Dun-Eaton. So Dunedin. The first annual Pepper Extravaganza will be accepting entries from May 13th through May 27th. Man, that'd be a fun one to judge, or at least to watch the sweat roll off the foreheads of the judges as they taste those spicy beers. I'll post a link to the Dunedin Brewers Guild, I hope I'm pronouncing it right, Dunedin Brewers Guild site in the description of this episode on basicbrewingradio.com. Well, we've got more great email, but not so much time this week. So let's get on to our interview with Chris Colby of Brew Your Own Magazine. Chris lets us in on a couple of articles that were in the latest issue of BYO. He tells us about the split personality of the India Pale Ale, its British roots, and its American evolution. Well, Chris Kobe, welcome again to Basic Brewing Radio.
Good morning, James.
We are we're talking this week about a favorite topic of, I'm assuming, a lot of our listeners out there, and that is India Pale Ales, or IPAs.
Yeah, IPAs, obviously a big favorite of homebrewers and, well, also beer drinkers. Yeah, it's a style that, well, it started in England, obviously. It was originally brewed in London. Then it sort of migrated to Burton-on-Trent, where it became very, very famous. And very recently, of course, in the United States, it got picked up by brewers here who sort of, you know, took the style and ran with it. And interestingly enough, it's still sort of spreading. I was at the beer store yesterday, and there's a Belgian brewery that makes well, at least a couple beers, one called Mick Choof and one called La Choof. And they actually have an IPA triple out now. I just got a 750 of that, and so I'm excited to try that. Some Scottish breweries, too, have started brewing IPAs, you know, sort of different than the usual Scottish ale, which is where the focus is on malt. So
is there a Belgian twist to the Belgian examples?
I don't know yet. I haven't tried it. I just got it yesterday. You know, I'm going to assume, because it's Belgian, that, yeah, there is. But, you know, I haven't tried it yet, so.
Would it be safe to say that Americans have really been maybe more enthusiastic about the style than where it originated?
Recently, yeah. In the new issue of BYO, we have two articles on IPA, one on American IPA that I wrote, and one by Terry Foster on English IPA. And he mentions that finding a good, you know, even a good English-style IPA in England these days is a little bit harder than you might think. You know, a lot of the most famous ones there are sort of large regional breweries, and, you know, at least according to him, they aren't that good, you know, that good of an interpretation of the style.
And Americans, with our typical fervor and gusto, have taken the style past the boundaries that were originally extreme, you know, for beer, the extreme bitterness. We've taken it way past where it was before.
Yeah, at least if I remember the sort of history of American IPA, this is something that I don't go into in the article. It's just focused on brewing. But the history is that Anchor started, or you know, the recent history was that Anchor started brewing Liberty here, and that was one of the first sort of big cascade-y, beers, and then it was followed by, you know, Sierra Nevada started putting out Celebration. I mean, they'd already put out their pale ale, which was, you know, a bigger, a more hoppier version of a pale ale, but then Celebration, you know, sort of like an IPA, much bigger. And then, you know, from there, there's a lot of other breweries, you know, just started picking up on that style. And subsequent to that, of course, there was sort of the second wave of the double IPAs hitting, and, you know, where the original gravity got bumped up, you know, another like 20 points or so, and the hops, you know, just people started just hopping the beer to saturation pretty much as far as bitterness is concerned. And yeah, so Americans have really taken to the style and taken it to the hoop, as it were.
Well, since you guys, you compare and contrast the USA example and the British example, let's kind of do that. First of all, let's start with just the style description. Where do the two styles compare, and where do they separate?
Right. Well, the two styles are very similar. They're both very hop-focused beer styles. When you taste an IPA, whether it's a good version of an English IPA or, you know, a really good American IPA, the focus is on hops. You want to taste a nice, clean hop bitterness up front. You want to taste hop flavor in the middle, and, you know, you want to have that hop flavor, you know, linger into the aftertaste. You want it, you know, to be hops in the beginning, hops in the middle, hops at the end. And both of those, you know, both the beers deliver. or you know, both the substyles deliver on that respect. And you know, the grain bill is also very similar for these two. They're both pale ale based beers or whatever. They're, you know, pale malt is the base. You know, a certain amount of crystal can be used in both. And one slight difference, though, is American sort of the, I'm trying to think of the right word, the sort of prototypical American IPA is a little bit lighter in color and a little bit better attenuated than sort of prototypical British style. You know, the British styles are mashed just a little bit higher for more fermentability. They may have a little bit more crystal malt in them, a little more specialty malt, and just, you know, a little bit bigger malt presence in the English styles, whereas the American styles, the little bit cleaner malt, highly attenuated, but a little stronger and more hops.
So they're both fairly, well, if you're used to hop bitterness, they're both fairly drinkable.
Yes, yeah. They're both, I mean, they're both hoppy, but at least compared to, you know, a lot of current versions of double IPAs and such, that the hops are, you know, they're big. There's, you know, a good hop bitterness, good, you know, full hop flavor and aroma, but not over the top.
And how would you characterize the contrast between the hop characteristics between the styles?
Well, the big thing is that the British style ones typically use, English hops. You know, particularly Kent Goldings is a hop that's used a lot in there. Although, actually, the use of American hops in English beers is something that goes way back, so it's not, you know, it's not absolutely clear cut. And but the sort of prototypical English examples will use, you know, Goldings or maybe a little Fuggles in the hopping. Whereas sort of the archetype of an American IPA is something with a lot of the big citrusy American hops, you know, particularly, you know, what people call the sea hops, like Chinook or Columbus, and, you know, especially Centennial and especially Cascades. Any of those, you know, very American tasting hops are what, you know, a lot of the very first IPAs that came out. And, you know, a lot of the very first sort of big hoppy beers that maybe weren't labeled IPAs in America, when those came out, you know, they featured Cascade hops or maybe Centennial, and that sort of carried through. A lot of people in an American IPA want sort of a characterful hop in their beer, not necessarily a, you know, Kent Goldings is a great hop, but, you know, has a very clean sort of hop bitterness, whereas with a lot of these American hops, there's a little more character. You know, there's the citrus in them, and there's, you know, the other things that sort of tip you off that's, you know, an American hop.
An American IPA is more in your face, I think, than an English style, wouldn't you say?
Typically, yeah. Everything is just everything except the color, and, you know, overall, a little bit stronger. It's a little bit more attenuated, which leads to a drier beer, but also definitely the hops are usually cranked up, like, you know, usually one notch, I would say, above English hops. They're not, you know, in a standard single American IPA, that, you know, the hops aren't just, you know, blown out compared to the English styles, but they're a little bit more, a little bit more forcible, more present.
And because you're using a lot of hops, and there is a lot of bitterness, and you want that bitterness to have a certain characteristic, where in other styles you may not worry about it so much, in this style you probably want to at least think about looking at your water in the brewing, right?
Right. Water is something that a lot of people pay attention to when they brew IPAs. I mean, I would argue that you should pay some attention to it for every beer you brew, but certain styles have become very, very, you know, sort of water-centric. Or people pay a lot of attention to it. And in IPAs, this is largely because where IPAs hit their sort of historical apex was in Burton-on-Trent, which has famously very, very hard water. So a lot of people, you know, now when you go to the homebrew shop, your homebrew shop may carry something called Burton salts, which, you know, supposedly you dump that in your water and it mimics Burton on Trent water. So, yeah, people pay a lot of attention to it. And the thing about both of these styles is you want a fair amount of calcium in the in your brewing water. You can add that either by adding gypsum, which is calcium sulfate, or you can add calcium chloride. You know, for any pale beer, you want sufficient calcium in the mash to establish a good pH. Second thing that you might want in the water is sulfate. Sulfate ions bring out the sort of hop character of the beer, accentuate the bitterness, and so you can add sulfate to the water if you need it by adding, you know, again, gypsum, calcium sulfate. So, you know, by adding that, you get sort of both of the things you need. And finally, one thing that you should pay attention to in your water is bicarbonate. And that's something you generally don't want in a pale beer. That tends to, it raises the mass pH and it dulls the beer out. And in hoppy beers, too much sulfate leads to a very, like, coarse hop presentation. The hops, you actually get more hop bitterness, but it's just very, it's like aggressive in an unpalatable way.
Hmm.
I would argue that there are some, you know, some of the higher cohumulin hops have an aggressive bitterness, but to me there's good aggressive and there's bad aggressive.
And would you recommend that someone get a water report from their local water supply before they go kind of mucking around and
Yeah, before you undertake any sort of water treatment plan, you need to know what's in your water initially. And I mean, one nice thing about although, you know, British were traditionally, you know, brewed with Burton on Trent water, and in America, I mean, the types of water they use to make IPA just run the gamut from, you know, very, very soft to very hard. You can, you know, if you're one of those people who just don't want to bother with all the you know, water treatment stuff, your first course of action might be just to brew a batch and see how it turns out.
Because
you have a, you know, especially with American styles, there's not really a fixed water profile that's best, you know, beyond what having sufficient calcium to establish the mash pH and that. But yeah, we give in the article, we give sort of suggested ranges for these things, you know, the different ions or whatever. Like for American ones, you know, you want less than 50 parts per million of bicarbonate. Although if you're brewing a more amber example, if you've got like more colored specialty malts, you can maybe creep up to about 100. For calcium, you want your calcium level at a minimum to exceed the level of bicarbonate. And then, you know, from there on, it can go anywhere from, you know, very little to, you know, to high levels. You know, in the article, I say up to 250 parts per million, but, you know, if you got higher than that, it, you know, it wouldn't be the end of the world really either.
So if you're an extract brewer, do you have to worry less about water treatment?
Yeah, you have to worry a lot less because, I mean, for one thing, your wort has been made for you and then condensed. So whatever sort of mineral profile that, you know, the malt extract producer used, you know, in their water is going to be, you know, either condensed or dried into your malt extract. So as an extract brewer, your best bet is to use a very soft water, either distilled water or if your water is naturally soft, and, you know, reconstitute that wort. It'll have then all the minerals that were present when the malt extract was manufactured. And, you know, if you want to, you can supplement by adding a little bit of calcium sulfate. You know, that's not going to hurt. And, you know, it might bring out a little bit of, you know, more hop bitterness. But probably the first time you try it with a specific kind of malt extract, your best bet as an extract brewer probably would be to use, you know, either soft or distilled water. First, you know, make the beer, taste it, and then, you know, see if you feel you need a little bit more gypsum first. because especially a lot of the English extracts are going to be made from fairly hard water anyway. So, you know, you might not need to be adding more drywall to your beer.
Along with the hops being forward on the style, it's also often described as being a malty style, and you do a good job of kind of defining what malty really means in beer, and there may be some misconceptions out there about what malty means.
Right. Malty is, I guess it shouldn't be surprising, but malty flavors come from malt. I mean, it seems like people would get that. But there is some confusion amongst homebrewers, and it's partially kind of understandable how it got that way. But basically, malty flavors come from malt. It's, you know, when malt is made, as we discussed on another show, they steep it, they let it germinate, but then they kill it. They heat it, and, you know, the husks, and, you know, somewhat penetrating into the interior, but mostly in the husks, there forms some Maillard products. They get heated, and, you know, there's some color and flavor develops. And when you mash the beer, you crush their grains, soak them in hot water, and the flavors and colors from the husk dissolve, you know, into your wort, and, you know, then survive the fermentation. That's where your malt flavors come from.
So a beer that's sticky sweet isn't necessarily malty.
Right. Basically, you know, in a beer, if you add more malt, it's going to be maltier, okay? But another thing that comes along with that, the more malt you add, you know, if all other things are kept equal, the higher it's going to finish, you know, the higher the final gravity. And that leads to a little bit, you know, more viscous, chewy, more sweet beer, you know. And so some people have sort of confused the two, and, you know, people will talk about, you know, sweet stouts being very, very malty, and it's like, well, not really. They're roasty and sweet, but that's, you know, not really malty. And but for IPAs, you know, either English or American, you do want it very malty. You want, in the English style, there's typically a nutty, biscuity kind of malt character, and paired with that, there's a sort of moderate finishing gravity to produce, you know, a sort of big beer to match the hops. And in the American style, you know, the color's lighter and there's more attenuation, creating a drier beer, and there's typically, at least in sort of the archetypical examples, you know, less crystal malt, so it's a, you know, cleaner beer, but there is a lot of malt. You know, they don't reach the higher gravities by adding, you know, like sugar, like in a, you know, a Belgian triple or something.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's an all-malt beer, and so even though it's all pale malt, you get a nice, you know, a nice maltiness. Even in a very light-colored beer, like Stone IPA is one of my favorite IPAs. And if you've ever poured one out, it's very light. I don't know what the SRM is, but, you know, certainly in the single digits and probably somewhere in the mid-single digits. But it's still very malty. You know, it's got a nice, clean, you know, malt profile that really sort of, you know, sets the stage for the hops. And, you know, like a Full Sail IPA is another one that's very, very light in color, and, you know, a lot of the other examples are.
So what would a malt bill look like for an American IPA, and how would that contrast with what a malt bill would look like for an English version?
Right. For an American IPA, your most straightforward choice for base malt would just be like domestic two-row malt. But, I mean, obviously here in America we have access to malts from all over, and, you know, you can use them if you want. You can go with an English malt. That's going to give you the more sort of English, you know, nutty, biscuity thing. You can go with, for sort of a cleaner one, you can go with, at least compared to the English, you can go with like a German Pilsner malt. Or you can, you know, you can blend two or more malts if you want together. You know, to, like, blending a couple base malts can make for, you know, like a subtle layer of complexity. But really, you know, domestic two-row malt, that's a great starting point for an American IPA. And then, you know, accentuated with a little bit of crystal malt. For an English IPA, you definitely want to, you know, you want to get that sort of English malt flavor, And so, you know, picking an English pale ale malt, the ones made from or malted from the Maris Otter variety of barley are very popular and make a very sort of prototypical British flavor in your beer. And so, you know, that's what a lot of people pick. That's what in his article Terry Foster recommends. And those, you know, you can also accentuate with a little bit of crystal malt, maybe a little bit more. You know, typical American IPA, you know, although they vary considerably, you know, maybe 5% crystal malt in an American IPA is a good target. And in English IPAs, again, where they, you know, they vary considerably, the original ones, in fact, crystal malt hadn't been invented yet when IPA sort of reached its heyday historically. But, you know, modern, maybe 10% is an English style IPA. And, you know, that's your malt bill for those two. It's, you can keep it very simple. You can, if you want, you can fiddle around with some little additions, like a lot of American IPAs will throw in a little bit of Munich malt to add, you know, some of that classic malty flavor and, you know, not very much color. You know, you can, in an English-style IPA, you can throw in a little bit of biscuit malt if you want. In either one, you could, you know, you could maybe experiment with a little bit of amber malt in there, you know, just enough to make a nice undercurrent of, you know, the amber malt flavor, although I wouldn't, you know, it, or at least it's not traditional to go nuts with that malt.
And if you do want to go nuts and experiment with different things, you may be straying outside the style guidelines, which is just fine. But since we are talking about the styles,
sure, you know, yeah. In the article, we keep it pretty close to what the styles are, you know, quote unquote supposed to be. But obviously, as a home brewer, and you know, as someone, if you're just making up your own beer at home for your, you know, your house ale or whatever, yeah, do whatever you want, and you know, you have a lot of options. But you know, if you're trying to make, you know, sort of a representative example of one of these styles, then simple hop bills are better.
What about for extract brewers? Would you start with a very light malt extract and then build on top of that with specialty malts and grains?
Yeah. For an extract brewer, you know, your starting point is going to be, you know, for an American IPA, find, you know, American, you know, light or pale malt extract. For an English one, find an English, you know, pale ale malt extract. There are even, I hear, Maris Otter sort of malt extracts available. And that would be a good start. And then, you know, supplement with a little bit of crystal. A somewhat better approach would be to do a mini mash. You know, you can, quote-unquote, steep some base grains along with your specialty grains, as long as you pay attention to, you know, the temperature that you steep them at and the volume of water you steep them in. So, you know, one thing that a partial mash will give you that a, like just plain steeping only the specialty grains won't, is you'll get a little bit more of that malt flavor and aroma in your beer, whereas in an extract beer, you know, when it's either condensed or dried, you do... I think, I mean, I've heard people, mainly malt extract manufacturers claim that it's not true, but I think you lose a little bit of the aromatics or whatever, and doing a partial mash returns some of that to the beer.
Now we come to the important part, the hops. Along with the hop varieties to choose, are there different hopping strategies to take for each style?
Yeah, IPA... And, you know, especially American IPAs, and then also if you expand it to think about American double IPAs, they've really explored just about every possible way to hop the beers. The, you know, the sort of traditional way to hop a beer, you know, a hoppy English-style ale, is, you know, you put a good dose of hops up front as your bitterness hops. You know, you boil that for, you know, either all of the boil or the last 60 minutes of the boil or something like that. You know, you boil hops really well, extract as much bitterness as you can, and then at the end you supplement it by adding in, you know, some late addition hops, and these can come either with, you know, starting at about 20 minutes left in the boil all the way to, you know, right at the end of the boil, or, you know, you can put in a couple additions, one, you know, with, say, 15 minutes to go and one with, you know, right at the end. Or, you know, you can have multiple editions within that framework, you know, or within that time range. And that's sort of, you know, the idea there is that you boil most of your hops for a long time, get as much bitterness out of them as you can, and then, you know, add hop flavor and aroma at the end, you know, by adding the late hops, which aren't boiled as long, and the, you know, the aromatic compounds won't completely, you know, vaporize and be boiled off. And, you know, for commercial brewers concerned with, you know, not having to pay for the hops, obviously, and then secondarily, in your wort, hops absorb water, and so the more hops you add, you know, means the more, you know, wort that those hops, the hop debris is going to, you know, soak up, and so you're losing, you know, wort that way, essentially. It's how commercial brewers would think about it. So the traditional way of hopping with, you know, big addition first and sort of supplemented with a small addition later is, you know, is a way that you get a good amount of bang for your buck. You know, you get as much bitterness as possible out, you get a nice flavor and aroma from the late addition, and you've added, you know, the least possible hops to get there. Another strategy, though, that a lot of American craft brewers, you know, use is, you know, multiple additions, including often many times additions through the middle of the boil, when normally, you know, most brewers, you know, traditionally wouldn't have done that. Because, you know, if you're adding, you know, a substantial amount of hops during the middle of the boil, they're not being boiled as long, so you're not extracting as much bitterness. But also, mid-boil hops are, you know, as in theory, you know, you're boiling them long enough to boil off a lot of the aroma and flavor, so you're sort of stuck in, you know, some people would argue a little bit of a vomit zone there, that you're just, you know, you're not getting as much bitterness, and yet you're boiling off the flavor and aroma. Other people would argue, of course, that you get, there is a character you get from adding hops to the middle of the boil, and there are, of course, a lot of American IPAs and double IPAs that, you know, employ a strategy where hops are added, you know, either multiple times throughout the boil or, you know, as in the case of Dogfish Head, straight through the boil. Like, to pick a normal IPA, Dogfish Head 60-minute is made with, you know, hops dribbled into the kettle throughout the boil. And, you know, obviously, they think that, you know, it's not wasting hops to add them in the middle boil and that gives them a character that they can't get. Whereas, you know, other very, very hoppy brews, like I know, well, this is a double IPA, but I know that Stone Ruination is produced mostly or entirely, I can't remember, with a single hop addition right at the beginning.
Huh.
So, you know, people have, commercial brewers do it both ways. It turns out well both ways. And so, you know, homebrewers should just, we're generally not too concerned with the economics. You know, if we want to add an extra ounce of hops, you know, the, however much, you know, the $1.50 that costs probably isn't going to, you know, break us. And likewise, if we, you know, the, you know, couple ounces of wort that, you know, gets absorbed by that, we're not going to fret over because we're, you know, we're brewing 5 gallons at a time. So, you know, homebrewers should really just experiment with the type of hopping they like. And, actually, there's a third kind where you can add, you know, with or without an initial bittering addition, you can add a very large amount of hops at the end. And there are some American beers, American hoppy beers, that actually most of the IPA, or I'm sorry, most of the IBUs, the bittering units, come from late addition hops. You've added so many hops late in the boil that actually your bitterness comes from there, and there's some people feel a different character to the you know, bitterness that you get from adding a lot of late hops. And of course, you know, adding a lot of late hops also makes a tremendous amount of hop flavor and aroma in your beer. So that's, you know, a third option, is to you know, go easy on your initial hop additions and then just, you know, lay it on in the end.
Yeah, I think I mentioned, I think we've talked about this, and I think I mentioned it on the show as well. I did an experiment lately with a Simcoe extract beer where I only boiled for 15 minutes, And what I did was I took the hops that I would have added at 60 minutes for bittering, doubled the amount, and added them at 15 minutes, which is the beginning of the boil, and then added the aroma hops and flavoring hops as usual. And man, the difference in hop flavor and aroma is incredible, especially using fresh Simcoe hops. It's just a wonderful thing to do. So, yeah, on the homebrew scale, you're not going to be spending thousands of dollars on hops or whatever to do this. We're not Anheuser-Busch or anything, but it's fun to play with late hopping additions and to just experiment with what that would do.
Yeah, I mean, if you have a way at the end of separating your hops and your wort, yeah, you definitely, you know, experimenting with when you add the hops, you know, is a great thing, and will, you know, let you explore different flavors. And I mean, also of course, adding hops in the boil is, you know, can be only the start for an IPA brewer. You know, there's traditionally, obviously, there's dry hopping, but you know, people have also tried things such as, you know, mash hopping, first wort hopping, mm-hmm. and then, of course, you have another thing that was sort of pioneered by Dogfish Head was, I guess you call it serving hopping. You know, they have the Randall where, you know, you have a column full of hops and you pull a pitcher of beer or foam, usually if you've seen one of those work, out at the, you know, at the end, and then, I mean, it settles down quickly, but, yeah, you can... There's definitely multiple ways to hop a beer. Oh, hop jack is another one that works very good. If you know what a hop jack is, it's like it's a little vessel that's in between your kettle and your fermenter, and or actually your fermenter and your chiller, and you run hot wort after the boil into it, and it's got a layer of hops, and so the all your wort, the hot wort, filters through the hops before it goes to the chiller. And this gives, of course, since the wort is hot but not boiling, it dissolves most of those aromatic compounds into the beer, and that carries off in, you know, into your wort and subsequently your beer. So that's another hopping option.
I'm waiting for someone to come up with like a hop tea bag that you can actually put in your glass as you're drinking, so that, you know, it's at the point of delivery as well. Or maybe like one of those little packets of chewing tobacco that you put in your mouth, you know.
Yeah.
Maybe you can – how much closer to the mouth can we get the hopping? But I'm encouraging all of that.
Just a plain old hop cone in your beer. I've done that a lot of times. Just a couple hop cones, and it probably doesn't do as much as – I think, but it's kind of fun.
So, did we cover the hopping strategies of the English side enough, do you think?
On the English side, they mostly stick with the traditional version, you know. I mean, there's certainly no reason you couldn't experiment, but, you know, classic English IPAs were, you know, big dose of bittering hops early on, and then, you know, a little bit of Kent Goldings or Fuggles at the end to round out the flavor.
So you've got all these hops in your kettle at the end of the boil, and you've cooled down your wort with an immersion chiller, let's say. What do you do with all that hop debris? How do you get around dealing with that?
Well, yeah, that's a good question. I mean, and that's sort of, you know, IPAs are brewed very much like a standard ale. You've got, you know, there's nothing really in their procedure that differs that much from other ales, but, you know, the one thing that does is that you've got a lot of hop debris at the end of your boil, and so you need some way to separate these out. If you're, you know, an all grain brewer and you have, you know, a plumbed kettle, one that has the spigot attached or whatever, you probably have a hop screen inside your kettle, you know, which is just sort of like a manifold with a screen over it, and you know, when you open the spigot and run the wort off, you know, the hop screen will screen out your hops. But a lot of brewers, you know, and especially stovetop brewers, just brew, you know, in a straight pot or a big kettle. And you sort of need some way to, you know, get your wort off that big layer of hops. And you have a couple options. One thing I do a lot when I brew a very hoppy beer is you'll cool the beer down, and then I'll just pull out the chiller, stick the cover on the kettle, you know, and I'll go, you know, clean equipment or whatever and you know, just let it settle for about an hour or two. You know, as long as the top's on the kettle, you shouldn't have to worry about contamination too much. And during that time, both the hot break or cold break and hop debris will settle and you know, it'll compact itself fairly well over that amount of time. And then you can just, you know, take your racking cane and siphon off the top. You can also, if you want to, if you go to a store that sells, you know, those stainless steel chore boys, they look sort of like Brillo pads, but they're actually made from stainless steel. If you get one, you know, this, of course, not treated with detergents or anything, but just, you know, one of those, you can just sort of crumple it up around the end of your racking cane. And in that case, you can, you know, you can go ahead pretty much and stick the racking cane all the way to the bottom and have that, you know, filter out the hop and stuff when you rack your wort over. Another thing you can do, if you just have a funnel with a screen in it, you can sanitize that. And you can either pour, like, your entire chilled wort through that and have the screen, you know, sort of separate the hops and the wort. Or I think a little better but option is to do, you know, let the material settle, you know, rack as much as you can off the top and then pour the last little bit through the funnel and have the that way simply your the funnel doesn't clog up by pouring all the wort through it. If you take a little sanitized spoon and just sort of scoop around at the right at the screen, you can keep it from clogging.
I found out that if I do a whirlpool, after I use an immersion chiller and I chill the wort, after I chill the wort, I take a sanitized big spoon and just stir the heck out of the wort and get it going really well, and just let it settle for, you know, 15, 20 minutes. And it makes it a whole lot easier to siphon. I use pellets. And so you can use a racking cane, and by putting the racking cane at the edge of the kettle and following the wort down as it comes out, you know, the debris is in a cone pretty much at the bottom, and you can keep your racking cane to the side and pretty much stay away from most of the debris.
Yeah, whirlpool. A lot of people, you know, commercial brewers use that a lot. You know, they actually have a special tank to do that in for that very reason. You know, the wort spins around and around, and, you know, the wort is forced to the outside of the kettle, and the solids, you know, sort of then, you know, get pushed inwards, and so they fall in a little cone in the middle.
When we did the Blind Mice Brew, way back, if you look in the archives, way back we did a Blind Mice Brew, and we had a lot of whole hops, and the whirlpool didn't work as well with whole hops, but with pellets it does work well. So once you've got the wort into the fermenter, talk about yeast and fermentation strategies and how they are similar and differ between the two styles.
Right. Well, they're similar in that, you know, you're brewing an ale in both cases. And the big difference between the two is that American ales are typically made with a, you know, what's called a clean ale yeast, one that doesn't produce a lot of those fruity esters, whereas in an English style, you expect a little bit more of that, you know, English style, you know, fruity ale character. Beyond that, the fermentation recommendations for both styles are very, very similar. You want to, since you're brewing a beer that's, you know, a little bit stronger than sort of an average strength beer, you know, IPAs are a little bit bigger, you definitely want to ensure that you pitch enough yeast, you know, to get a good healthy ferment. And this is, you know, it's true for both styles, but maybe a little bit more true for American styles because you're shooting for a fairly, you know, high level of attenuation in an American ale, and you're not going to get it if you underpitch. Likewise, you in both styles you want to aerate well. You don't IPA is not a style where you need to go nuts with aeration. You don't have to, you know, aerate multiple times, you know, leading up to high Heikreuzen or anything. But you do want a good shot of aeration at the beginning. And then, of course, you want to keep control of your temperatures. You know, standard ale temperatures work well for an IPA. You might want to shy away from, you know, the very upper range of that because, you know, with a slightly thicker wort, you know, the wort's going to heat up on its own due to fermentation. And, you know, you wouldn't want the heat of fermentation then to push yourself over the range, you know, and lead to a more fruity, you know, beer than you planned for. Also, you know, you've got a lot of the hop aromatics in your wort, and the vigor of fermentation is going to, you know, affect how many of those you blow off. And so if you keep it sort of on the cooler end of fermentation, you know, you still want a vigorous fermentation. You don't want to, you know, try to increase your hop aroma by having a sluggish fermentation. But, you know, keeping it a little cooler and still running a good fermentation, you retain, you know, just a little bit more of the hop aromatics that way. So, I mean, I personally, when I do an American IPA or just any sort of hoppy ale, I like to use the, you know, either Weiss 1056 or White Labs 001, the, you know, sort of the Chico strain or whatever. There's also a dried version of it available now. And, you know, ferment sort of on the low end of where that will work well. And, you know, that retains, you know, it'll still, that yeast will still, you know, chug away and get the attenuation you want. But, you know, leaves a nice hop aroma left over.
And on the English side, you want a warm enough fermentation to get the fruity esters, but not so warm that you start getting off flavors from the higher alcohols, right?
Right, yeah. In the English strain, I mean, you can still, the strains themselves are fruity enough that, you know, you can ferment even on the low end of their range, and you'll still pull out a little bit of that fruit. But as the, you know, as the temperature increases, you know, you're getting increasing, you know, amount of the fruity esters out of there. And, you know, for that, that's the sort of thing where if you've never, you know, if you're using a nail strain, an English strain that you've never used before, you know, take really good notes about, you know, what temperature you fermented at, and then taste the beer and take really good notes about the fermentation characteristics. You know, was it, how estery was it, did you like it, blah, blah, blah. And then, you know, the next time you brew, adjust it according to that. You know, if you're an experienced brewer and you've used a strain over and over, you're going to have a pretty good idea of, you know, what temperature range produces what sort of characters, and you can, you know, use your own experience that way. But as a you know, as a brewer who hasn't used a particular strain, probably best to shoot for sort of the middle of the recommended range to start off with. That'll give you sort of the average character of the yeast, and then you can work, you know, work your way from there to do, you know, to manipulate the subtle changes in, you know, yeast performance and characteristics.
Well, as usual, at the end of the conversation, I'm thirsty after talking to you, Chris. And
thirsty for IPA, but it's only 11 o'clock in the morning.
Shh.
What a bitter, bitter dilemma, so to speak.
It's 5 o'clock somewhere. Well, I enjoyed talking to you, and I enjoyed seeing you and Jennifer down in Austin when I was down there recently. And I hope that Kelly and I didn't bore you too much with too many funeral home stories and such as that.
No, it was fine. And you got recognized, too. We were at the draft house, and someone came up to James and said, "Oh, I recognize you for your, you know, your podcast or whatever."
Yeah.
And then, funnily enough, you said, "Oh, and this is Chris from BYO," and the guy just like shrugged, like, "Nah, whatever."
Yeah, I think his name was Garrett, maybe. You know, I get recognized so infrequently that I can remember everybody. But yeah, that was fun. I really appreciated him coming up and just shaking my hand. And, you know, he didn't buy me a beer or anything, but, you know.
Yeah, he could have gone that extra mile.
I can't look a gift horse in the mouth there. But anyway, well, I appreciate your time again, Chris. Happy brewing to you.
You too.
Well, thanks again to Chris Colby for spending time with us. It's always fun to talk to Chris. If you click on the banner ad for BYO on basicbrewing.com or basicbrewingradio.com, you can get a free issue of that magazine. And if you subscribe after you get that free issue, you will be helping to support this podcast. And we appreciate everybody who's done that so far. I look forward to BYO when it comes every time. Next week, I will probably run the show that I recorded with Andy Sparks. Andy talked a bit about the Strong Ale Festival he attended in Boulder. And we finally get to go over your email about brewing software. So you'll want to tune in for that. Speaking of brewing software, remember, if you follow the link from last week's show to Kent Place Software, you Mac users can get 25% off the full price of Beer Alchemy, brewing software for the Mac. I think it's 25% off. Just use the coupon code BASICBREWING when you check out. That's BASICBREWING, all one word. If you have brewing questions, show suggestions, or just want to say howdy, write to james@basicbrewing.com or just fill out the contact form on basicbrewing.com. And please don't forget to tell us where you're from. And while you're on our site, you can check out our online shop where you can find great pricing on our DVDs and a combo deal to save you even more. In Basic Brewing Introduction to Extract Home Brewing, we walk you through the extract brewing process step by step from boiling to bottling. And in Basic Brewing Stepping into All Grain, we take you through the all grain process from milling your grain to collecting your wort, and including batch sparging and fly sparging, step mashing and infusion mashing. It's all there. And you can see a growing listing of the fine folks across the country who sell our DVDs on basicbrewing.com. And if there isn't a vendor in your area, you can order it online from us, and I will box it up for you myself. And thanks to everybody. Thanks to all of our homebrew shops out there who are selling the DVDs. That's just wonderful. And also thanks to everybody who's continued to click on our Amazon.com link. We appreciate the support there. Our featured products this week that were purchased through the link are the Canon PowerShot SD1000 7.1 megapixel digital ELF camera with 3x optical zoom. Black, by the way. And the soundtrack from Garden State. It's good stuff on there. Thanks again, everybody. And remember, I can't tell who bought what, so no worries there. Just click on the Amazon.com logo on our site the next time you feel like Amazon shopping, and we'll get a little chunk of that. And we appreciate your support. That's all until next week. Until then, thanks for listening, everybody. I'm James Spencer. Production help for Basic Brewing Radio and our website is provided by Kelly Dodson, who's in Austin and also designed our logo. Basic Brewing Radio is a production of Active Voicing. We'll talk to you next time, everybody. So long.